From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the first US case of the deadly Ebola virus is confirmed in Texas after a man who travelled from Liberia fell ill with symptoms of the virus.
This case is serious. Rest assured that our system is working as it should. Professionals on every level of the chain of command know what to do to minimize this potential risk to the people of Texas.
Also today, Prime Minister David Cameron tells the people of Britain why he deserves to stay in the top job. And as the pro-democracy supporters continue to unite in Hong Kong, protests of support spread across the US.
Peaceful demonstration, no violence, but if we don't stand up right now against it, there will be no future for Hong Kong.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Demonstrators in Hong Kong are threatening to occupy government buildings if the chief executive does not resign his post. Student leader Lester Shum says CY Leung has until Thursday to step down or face an escalation in the protest movement. Demonstrations continued in the streets of Hong Kong Wednesday, which was a national holiday in China, with participants demanding a free choice of candidates for elections. The director of the U.S. Secret Service, Julia Pearson, has resigned after multiple lapses in the president's security were revealed. Meanwhile, the man accused of jumping the White House fence has pleaded not guilty to charges that he ran into the presidential mansion while carrying a knife. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
Julia Pearson had faced tough questions on Capitol Hill on Tuesday over several cases of lapsed presidential security. She accepted full responsibility and said there would be a comprehensive review. But she failed to mention an incident where an armed security contractor with three convictions for assault and battery rode in an elevator with the president last month. She resigned on Wednesday and will be replaced in the interim by Joseph Clancy, a former special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division of the agency. Kate Fisher, Washington.
Health officials in the U.S. state of Texas are working with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control to trace the contacts a man diagnosed with Ebola made before he was admitted to a hospital. But officials were quick to reassure Americans that an outbreak of Ebola is extremely unlikely. U.S. correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
The man diagnosed with Ebola is being treated on a special ward at Texas Presbyterian Hospital. Dr. Mark Lester of Texas Health Resources.
We're categorizing his condition as serious but stable.
But many questions remain about his care before his admission. An investigation is underway into how his medical and travel history was not relayed to the evaluation team in the emergency room. And Texas Governor Rick Perry says they are tracking down anyone who has been in contact with the patient, including children.
Are working to identify, to locate, and monitor the health of all of those who have come into close contact.
U.S. officials continue to insist the risk of Ebola infection is low in the United States.
Figures from the United Nations show that more than 1,100 people were killed and almost 2,000 injured in Iraq during the last month. The spread of the Islamic State has led to a dramatic increase in the violence in the country. Here's Nick Harper.
With the figures came a warning that the 1,100 death toll for September is undoubtedly much lower than the actual number. The UN mission in Iraq said it was unable to collect data from areas controlled by the Islamic State, which now accounts for a third of the country. The mission, based in the capital Baghdad, said its figure was an absolute minimum. Nick Harper, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An artillery shell has killed four people at a school in the rebel-held eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk on the first day of classes for children, according to officials. Six more people died when a minibus in Donetsk was also hit. Anya Ardayeva reports from Moscow.
A biology teacher and parent, but no children, were among the dead, witnesses told the Reuters news agency. The school is just a few kilometers away from Donetsk airport, where pro-Russian militants have clashed with Ukrainian troops. Despite a ceasefire signed on September 5th, there have been frequent violations. Both sides blamed each other for Wednesday's attack. Open conflict began in April after Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. Anya Ardayeva, Moscow.
And a former prisoner at Guantanamo Bay has walked free in the UK after terrorism charges against him were dropped. Mozambique had been accused of attending a terrorist training camp in Syria. Ollie Barrett has more.
At a pre-trial review, Mozambique was told the Crown Prosecution Service had insufficient evidence to continue with the case due to start on Monday. He was accused of attending a terrorist camp in Syria between October 2012 and April 2013 and of possessing documents connected to terrorism and terrorism funding. Mozambique's supporters say the now-collapsed case has shown the criminalisation of Muslims travelling to Syria, often for aid and humanitarian purposes. He spent nearly 3 years at Guantanamo Bay after being detained in Pakistan in 2002, but was never charged with any offence while in US custody.
For more of today's news, follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The first US case of the deadly Ebola virus has been confirmed in Texas after a man who travelled from Liberia fell ill with symptoms of the virus. Officials at a North Texas hospital have admitted to making a mistake in diagnosing the patient with Ebola. Dr. Mark Lester with Texas Health Resources says a nurse originally thought the patient had a common virus and allowed him to return home. The victim, whose condition has been described as serious, flew from Liberia to Dallas this month before being diagnosed on Tuesday. The man is the first person to bring the disease to the United States from West Africa, where it has killed thousands of people in recent months. Dr. Amesh Adalja is an infectious disease physician at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
No, I don't believe this is a time to panic. This case in Dallas is something that we expected would occur. This is the largest outbreak of Ebola in history, and with modern travel patterns, it was only a matter of time before the United States had an imported case. And we've been preparing for this over the last few months. Hospitals have been developing protocols. The CDC has developed a lot of guidance for healthcare providers in the United States in the event that an Ebola patient was diagnosed here.
Well, that's what's happened, and those protocols will now be put into action. Could you walk us through what some of those will be for this individual who's been infected?
So the protocols will be specific to the hospital, the state, and the locality in which the hospital is in. But in general, what that would involve was isolating the patient with putting the patient in droplet or what we call droplet precautions or contact precautions so that staff are not exposed to that patient's blood and body fluids. There'll be protocols for what blood tests will be run, how they'll be run. Are they going to be sent to the regular hospital lab, or are they going to be done at the point of care using devices that may be specific to that patient? The other protocols will have to do with visitation, how many visitors will the patient be allowed to have. Mm-hmm. There'll be protocols regarding his contacts that he had while he was symptomatic. Yes. How will they be followed up? How will they be monitored? And then lots of protocols regarding, how will you handle the waste from that patient when he goes to the bathroom? How will that be handled? How will you, what kind of treatment are you going to offer this patient? Is he going to get some experimental treatments, or what supportive care is he going to get? All of those protocols would have been thought out by hospitals ahead of time, hopefully, and are now being put into play with this patient at Texas Presbyterian.
And those health workers, along with the people who this individual may have been in contact with, orbiting this case, they will be looking for symptoms there as well. Can you remind us of what they are?
So the primary symptom that people will be looking for is fever, and that could be associated with a rash, muscle aches and pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. Those types of symptoms are what the health official will be on the alert for in this patient's contacts.
Right. And in terms of a more effective form of treatment, we know that Kent Brantley, Nancy Reitbol, those two Americans who were in West Africa and were infected with Ebola, were treated using the experimental drug ZMAP. But is there anything else on the horizon that may be able to help with this treatment of this virus?
The first thing that's going to happen is these patients are going to get good supportive care. That means IV fluid, controlling their vomiting, controlling their fever, getting oxygen if they need it. There are a few experimental therapies that are available instead of, in addition to ZMAP. We know that Dr. Sakra, the individual who got infected in Africa and was treated in Nebraska, got a novel Canadian product by Techmira Pharmaceuticals. That's available. There is a Japanese antiviral called Favipiravir that's used in influenza that's available. So there really are a whole host that could be used. It'll just be based upon what the patient's physicians and the patient himself thinks about which experimental therapy is available. That's important because these are very scarce products, and which ones he is a candidate for. But I'm sure that there will be a lot of discussion about which experimental therapy or combination of them is warranted in this patient.
This case on U.S. soil will no doubt focus our attention back to the source, which is West Africa, where the problem is, where thousands have died through Ebola infection. What is the United States doing, or what should it be doing to try and contain this outbreak?
What we've seen is an unprecedented response from the United States, the biggest response in the CDC's history to control this outbreak. And that involves sending epidemiologists, providing guidance, and then you've also seen the Department of Defense in an unprecedented move as well, mobilize to Africa and have committed to constructing 1,700-bed hospitals, providing diagnostic support, providing a lot of logistical support. This is really a full-scale adventure by the United States government in order to control this Ebola outbreak, with the recognition that the only way that we can prevent this outbreak from spreading around the world and having imported cases in other places is by controlling it at the source. And that's true for all infectious diseases.
So given those numbers and your expertise, do you think this will be the last case of Ebola diagnosed in the United States?
I don't think it will be the last case. There is bound to be more importations, and I think we have to be prepared for them, and hospitals have to be astute enough to have their clinicians asking the travel history of their patients so that these cases are identified promptly. I believe we will get, we had multiple importations of SARS when the SARS outbreak occurred in 2003. We had two importations of MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. So the United States is definitely a place where these diseases can be imported to, and this outbreak is unprecedented in its scale and scope. So we have to be prepared to see more than just this one patient here. I don't believe that there's going to be any major secondary transmission from these cases because we're very adept at managing infection control issues in the United States, and Ebola will not find the U.S. to be a hospitable place to spread.
Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. This is FSN Reports. Pro-democracy crowds continue to dig in on the streets of Hong Kong. In their tens of thousands, people are protesting over China's proposed meddling in a 2017 election in Hong Kong. Tom Grundy is a journalist in the region and has been following events on what is also a national holiday for China. LBC's Lisa Aziz began by asking him if the protests had remained peaceful.
Very much so. I'm in Admiralty, where the government headquarters are. There are three other occupation areas across the city and shopping thoroughfares. There are still hundreds of people arriving here as the day warms up. It's a very humid day. People are using the umbrellas that were previously shielding them from tear gas as their parasols today. If it is, people dressed in solemn black with yellow ribbons for universal suffrage. Quite a jovial, festive atmosphere, people sharing food. There was a barbecue even at one point the other night, and a DJ, as people have reclaimed the streets. Talk of perhaps pushing into the central business district today, and yet still thousands of people gathered, some stayed overnight here in Admiralty.
And we know, Tom, what these protesters want, but fair to say it's hard to imagine them getting it.
Yeah, I mean, Beijing is stuck between a rock and a hard place, though. 11 years ago, there was an almost million-man march where people ousted the first post-colonial leader of Hong Kong, Tung Chee Hwa. So it is perhaps possible that the maligned chief executive, C.Y. Leung, here in Hong Kong may step down. That's what they're demanding. But in terms of Beijing budging on the issue of one person, one vote, it seems there may not be much movement on this restrictive conservative model that they announced in August.
Freelance journalist Tom Grundy reporting from Hong Kong. And sympathy for the Hong Kong protesters has been demonstrated at events across the world, with Washington DC no exception, as FSN's correspondent Lorna Shaddock found out.
We need a stronger message from the US government saying that any political dispute should be resolved peacefully. We don't want to see Tiananmen Square massacre, second Tiananmen Square massacre take place in Hong Kong.
I think that a universal understanding, one person, one vote, is that every person has a role. Doesn't mean that someone choose somebody for you to vote. Peaceful demonstration, no violence, but if we don't stand up right now against it, there will be no future for Hong Kong.
I just came here by megabus. It was a 12 hours overnight bus. This is running a long trip, but this demonstration is very important for me as a citizen of China. I feel it's my responsibility to make my voice heard and also to show our support for those who are staying in the central of Hong Kong. They are sleeping on the ground.
I think there needs to be a very clear statement from the United States government indicating that we are watching the response from Beijing in relation to these protests, and that we will stand for absolutely no sort of violent crackdown the way that happened in Tiananmen Square 25 years ago.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock with opinion from protesters gathered outside the Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C. today. Now, the British Prime Minister has asked Britons to give him the chance to finish the job he started on the UK's economic recovery. He's also promised to ensure cuts aren't made to the National Health Service, lower taxes for 30 million people, and that he'll tackle immigration. David Cameron was speaking at the last Conservative Party conference before the general election next May. Our correspondent Natalie Feary takes a look at what his chances are of winning another election with less than 6 months to go.
Speaking of his love for Britain, David Cameron made an emotional appeal to voters to give him another 5 years as Prime Minister. And he wanted to convince them that his party is not just about cuts, because despite the UK economy growing, the rising cost of living is affecting many families. So he promised to put money back in their pockets.
The 40p tax rate was only supposed to be paid by the most well-off people in our country. But in the past decade, far too many people have been dragged into it. Teachers, police officers. So let me tell you this today. I want to take action that's long overdue and bring back some fairness to tax.
Other policy announcements on health service spending, affordable housing and more apprenticeships for young people were also set out and are seen as a response to the Labour Party's pledge to make Britain fairer. But there were no details on how this would all be paid for, which could be damaging for the Prime Minister, according to Tom Majinski, head of political polling at ComRes.
Whether people start questioning how they're going to make those tax cuts, how that's going to be funded, and whether that becomes the issue, could certainly hurt David Cameron. He's going on a sort of optimistic message, but he may well be derailed if people start to question him how that's going to be implemented.
Which is not something the Conservative Party can afford to let happen. Recent polls show the Conservatives lagging behind the Labour Party, and the Conservative Party also faces challenges from the right, with two recent defections of its MPs to the UK Independence Party, though David Cameron was keen to point out that voting for UKIP would play into the hands of the Labour Party. But the Prime Minister is more popular than his opponent, as Tom Majinski points out.
The argument from Labour critics is that they should be further ahead and that Ed Miliband is stopping that. Whereas David Cameron's personality comes across well on TV, he's very personable, and that seems to be winning him popularity, even if not for the party.
Whether they base their decision on the party or its leader, voters now have just over 6 months to choose who they think will provide a better future for them and their families. Natalie Feary, London.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, which looks at former President Nicolas Sarkozy's decision to return to frontline politics, a move which almost certainly suggests he's planning another push for power in the 2017 presidential race. A move given current President François Hollande's record lows in the polls that may not be as bold as it first appears. Gideon Rachman is joined by Hugh Carnegie, Paris Bureau Chief, and Tony Barber to discuss Sarkozy's chances.
Hugh, How big a deal is this, Sarkozy's announcement? Was it expected, and how much does it change the way we look at French politics?
I think it's an important moment, and it was expected. There had been signals coming out of the Sarkozy camp for some time that he was about to make this announcement. He had signaled over the summertime that he would make his decision in September, and so he has. Interestingly, though, what he is doing initially is running to lead the UMP party, his centre-right party, as president of the party. That is, in effect, a kind of the senior administrative role in the party. The UMP has been all over the place, really, ever since Sarkozy lost to Hollande in 2012, particularly so earlier in this year when a financial scandal upended its previous president and the party was, in a way, adrift with a sea of debt, by the way, as well. Sarkozy's strategy now is to say, OK, I'm going to take control of the party, assuming he gets elected president at the special congress at the end of November. I'm going to take over the party. I'm going to shake it up, give it a real thorough transformation, in brackets, shape it in my form, and use it as a machine that we now all assume to run for the presidency in 2017.
Now, what are his chances? I mean, do you think we're now, as a result, likely to be looking at a Sarkozy comeback? And I saw that you wrote in the paper that the only two presidents in French history are Charles de Gaulle and Napoleon Bonaparte.
Yes, and a colleague pointed out the Napoleon example wasn't necessarily a very good one because things ended badly for him, as we know. I think that Sarkozy perceives clearly that the weakness of Hollande and particularly the very poor state of the French economy and the general morosity over the state of the country gives him a real chance to, in effect, achieve his revenge for 2012. It won't necessarily be very straightforward, though. First of all, he's going to face quite a lot of opposition within the UMP. He's still very popular with the party's activists, which will stand him in good stead. But we have, for example, Alain Juppé, the former prime minister and former foreign minister under Sarkozy, who has said he is determined to run for the candidacy of the UMP for the election in 2017, as has François Fillon, who was prime minister under Sarkozy during Sarkozy's presidency. So Sarko is now launched back into the hurly-burly of opposition politics. And I think there's a risk from his point of view, especially with him coming back so early, after all, there's still 2.5 years until the vote, that his re-entry into, as it were, the kind of daily sticks and stones of French politics will erode whatever certain kind of cachet he has from his previous role as president.
Now, Tony, I mean, obviously the state of France is crucial to the future of the European Union and a big worry, I think, in Berlin, where traditionally there's been a close Franco-German relationship. How do you think the Germans and others will be seeing the return of Sarkozy to frontline politics?
I think that in Berlin and countries that look at European economic policy making in particular with what one might call a German eye won't be filled with great enthusiasm at the possibility of his return as president of France, because they remember his leadership between 2007 and 2012 as being a little bit too wayward for their tastes. And in particular, even before the financial crisis burst upon Europe a couple of years into his presidency, they knew him as someone who made loud calls, for example, for European Central Bank interest rate cuts, for the sort of flexibility on fiscal policy that you naturally now see from the socialist government in France. And they remember him as someone who never really got to grips with the sort of deeper economic reforms aimed at rejuvenating the French economy that they, the Germans in particular, see as the root of the problem in France and what really needs to be done. So what I think they would be hoping for in the presidential contest of 2017 is a contest between figures who really do have some credibility as potential economic reformers. I'm not sure they are convinced that Sarkozy can reinvent himself as such a reformer.
And give us a sense, Tony, of how crucial what happens in France is to the general European project.
I personally think it's terribly important because the European project has depended for many decades on a certain kind of balance between France and Germany. And that balance simply doesn't exist anymore. Economically, Germany has moved some way ahead of France, and therefore it makes for a rather awkward atmosphere when European leaders get together. And the old idea that France could lead politically while Germany led economically, that also doesn't work quite so well since the reunification of Germany in 1990.
Now, Hugh, Tony's just reminded us that there are reasons for France's European partners to be a little sceptical about Sarkozy's record, but I also gather that he's actually become, if anything, more Eurosceptic over the past couple of years. Is that the case?
I've certainly not become less so. He did publish an article just before the European elections in May in which he proposed that Europe should basically become very clearly a two-speed Europe, with the 28, the outer ring, as it were, being reduced to sort of pretty much a kind of what perhaps would be popular in London, a kind of loose trade association with much less powers exerted by Brussels. And the inner core, the Eurozone, should become essentially a German-French fiefdom. And he argued for less powers and the removal of equality for small countries, which he said had no business telling France and Germany what to do, police their borders. So yes, there is a strong Eurosceptic line in Sarkozy's discourse at the moment.
And to what extent is that a response to the rise of the National Front, who in some opinion polls I see Marine Le Pen was actually down as somebody who could beat François Hollande in a two-person race for the presidency?
Well, I think that the rise of the National Front and Marine Le Pen is the big question that lurks over both Sarkozy and the UMP and, of course, Hollande and the Socialist Party right now. It's something that Sarkozy is bearing very strongly in mind, and he will, I think, definitely pose himself as the person who can defeat her. And to do that, he does have to adapt policies that are somewhat to the right. Whether that is successful is very much open to question, though. There is a lot of signals coming out of the National Front camp right now that they are, in effect, rather rubbing their hands at the prospect of fighting Sarkozy. They think that he's completely devalued on the right after the failures of his own presidency, and that they can give him a real run for his money. Marine Le Pen was making remarks the other day which effectively was saying, bring him on.
So, Tony, I mean, as you said, the sort of huge question, partly, I guess, because it's such an extraordinary prospect, is it possible to imagine a President Marine Le Pen? Is it possible for you? And what do you think the rest of Europe is thinking? Are they taking it seriously?
It still seems a remote possibility, but it is slightly less fantastic a possibility than it might have seemed a year ago. I think one does need to bear in mind that when she and the National Front took 25% or so of the vote in the European Parliament election in France in May and came top of the polls, this was not because 25% of the French people had become far right. Most of that support was coming from people within the normal traditional spectrum of French voting patterns, but they were disillusioned with the centre-right and the socialists and other options. So Sarkozy does have a point when he says, I want to win back some of that support for the traditional right. The problem is that the themes he is likely to use are those that are more convincingly evoked by the National Front. If he were to campaign on a platform of thoroughgoing economic reform that would appeal to France's European partners, it's not by any means certain that he would win back those centre-right and other voters that have drifted towards the National Front. I think it's not at all clear that that section of the electorate that has gone for the National Front is going to shrink in 2017.
Gideon Rackman was joined by Hugh Carnegie, Paris Bureau Chief, and Tony Barber. And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone, with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.